Hello and welcome to the Syngene podcast. My name is Pauline Hamsey-Vinson, Interim Director of the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. The Syngene podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and the Arab American National Museum. We open today's episode with Eli Tar El-Bashalani Lynch reading from The Good Arabs.
The cycle. One. These days, I see capitalism written plainly in every poem, though the poetry masters say, show, don't tell. But if we were to show this indiscernible void, the make-believe of pieces of paper, sometimes coin, that make the world go, not round, but into the hands of the few, would this change how you see this intoxication with power? Two. He looks up from his food, a hamburger between two slices of bread, and asks as though this were the most important question. Will Teta have enough khubuz to eat back home? Three. Article 534 of the Lebanese Penal Code prohibits having sexual relations that are contradicting the laws of nature, which is punishable by up to a year in prison. As a practical matter, enforcement of the law has been varied and often occurs through occasional police arrests. That is to say, this law was put in place by the French government in the early 1900s. They say a relic. I say a shift in the century, a matter of public privacy. She says, Ibishum, which means we have absorbed their respectability. Four. These days, I see more people looking for work. It is unavailable. Those of us in the service industry must risk our lives or risk our lives. There's never really a choice. One way or another, they will ultimately claim us. Who are they? We don't even know. The facelessness makes them undetectable. Five. I marvel at the care I find in my neighbors, in my friends, in the people on the internet tweeting dark jokes that sustain me through another day. This weakness in us, in you, in me, is not weakness, but a sickness, not always of our own making. We try our best to help each other, but they do not let us. Tents are destroyed. Shelters must be sober. The snow falls for the first time, and though the streets glimmer white, it is not a good omen. Six. One day there is money, the next there is not. The value plummets, though the pieces of paper still look the same. The lira sitting in my old wallet, hidden away. Seven. The riots begin, a consequence of so much death. It only makes sense. We debate whether this is the right recourse or not. This is not up for debate. What is the difference between objects and people? When we turn certain people into objects, we become monsters. Ugliness seen not in the way we look, but in our hearts, drying up yellow, quickly redirect our attention. Seven, the riots begin. A consequence of so much death. It only makes sense. Eight. The death of one political man means nothing. I would say woman or person, but it is almost always a man. They replace one man with another, and is always the same. This time, it is in our faces. Escalated, some of us adapt. The men are starving, but not for food. This insatiable hunger leaves us wanting for more. Nine. But what is a homosexual who is not a homosexual outdoors, not indoors, not in private? But what is an Arab who is not a homosexual, who is not an Arab, who is not a homosexual? Read, you may only transition if you have the surgery. That is to say, you must become one of us. 10. read a year in prison, read the police are called, read the bars are raided, read acts contradicting the laws of nature, read at the hands of the police, read and the military, read. I will not describe to you what violations occur, what a prison looks like, if only to stop the violence from reoccurring on the page.
Eli is a writer living in Diogaye, which is current Montreal. Their work has appeared in the Best Canadian Poetry 2018 anthology, The New Quarterly, ARC Poetry Magazine, and elsewhere. They were longlisted for the CBC Poetry Prize in 2019. Their book, Not Body, and Not is K-N-O-T, Not Body 2020, published by Metatron Press, was shortlisted for the QWF Concordia First Book Award. And their second book, The Good Arabs, published by Metonymy Press in September 2021, won the Grand Prix du Livre de Montréal, the Montreal Book Prize, and garnered an honorable mention by the Arab American National Museum. They are an acquisitions editor at Metonymy Press, and currently they are translating Gabrielle Bullion Tremblay's La Fille d'Elle-Même from the French, forthcoming fall 2023. With co-editor Samia Mershi, they are editing El Ghuraba, an anthology of weird and experimental queer and trans writing by Arab and Anglophone writers. Welcome, Eli, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start. The first thing that a reader encounters in a book is the book cover and the title. And I love your title. It's so intriguing and it really pulled me in right away. Immediately evokes so many resonances at once. Can you talk to us a little bit about this title, how you came to choose it and that process?
Yeah, definitely. When I first was coming to try to pick a title, I always feel like I'm bad at titles. And so I was sitting in the studio that I used to work at, kind of coming up with names and trying to think through it and being like, what can I use to encompass everything? I was just like, I don't know. And often when I don't know what to name a large collection, I look into the poems and think about the individual poems and what they're doing, and maybe basically taking one of the poems' names to signify the whole, a bit as a cheat. You know, I'm like, I already named some things. I like what they are called. I'll try to take one from them. I figured that the poem, The Good Arabs, which kind of talks about so many things, it talks about both the beautiful things about Arab community and the darker sides of things happening within Arab community and Arab spaces. And I wanted that to kind of be the thing that resonated throughout the book as kind of a first thought that, you know, I'm not talking about just the good things or just the bad things, that it's complex, that it's also a massive community and I'm not talking about everyone. After that, I also wanted it to be a bit provocative and to kind of push against the idea of the bad Arab, the terrorist, the, you know, the idea of the Arab that is very much in the media in particularly North America, but kind of the whole world, and what it would mean to outwardly say The Good Arabs on a title and have people see that title. And it wasn't the first thought, but once I was thinking about it, I was like, this is perfect.
Lovely. I love that. It's for Arabs, The Good Arab, but it's also for a non-Arab, The Good Arab, and how that resonates differently.
So, yeah, exactly.
So that's really nice. Yeah. So maybe this is a good time to talk about the titular poem, The Good Arabs. Let's see, what page is it on? Page 63. Do you want to talk a little bit about that poem?
Yeah.
Do you want to read maybe the first stanza?
Yeah, sure.
And talk a little bit about it.
All right. The Good Arabs. Hassan hasn't talked to me or anybody since the day of green seas, and we reduce it to absence, but they said it's a changing in the weather that signals more to come. And we're trying to understand, but this isn't a jump off the cliff move. It's not a change built over time. I can tell this isn't going anywhere I want it to. That's the most mysterious part of the poem, actually. And then it starts off in that mystery and kind of starts breaking apart, I would say, and being more specific. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about colorism and anti-blackness in the Arab community and the way that that permeates, particularly as a Lebanese person, where there is lots of people in Lebanon who employ domestic workers, and there's laws that make it so that people can treat domestic workers really badly. And often a lot of those domestic workers are Black women who come from places like Ethiopia. That's like a, you know, a big thing to contend with. And as I was writing that poem, that was one of the things that I was thinking about, kind of coming to terms with the way that part of the way I was raised was to have this anti-Blackness. And as someone who's kind of worked through it a lot and who's tried to unpack anti-Blackness and who's also tried to, you know, be in solidarity with Black folks, it doesn't mean that I still don't come from this place, right? And just because I can kind of work on myself, there's also, you know, my family, there's the whole country, there's other Arab communities. And so I kind of wanted this poem to push a bit against the idea of the Arab who doesn't want to get too dark. I also wanted it to push against the upward mobility of Arabs who maybe are thinking about the ways that they can get more or, like, you know, survive in a new place, particularly Arabs who immigrate, but also Arabs like in, or like Lebanese people in Lebanon, and how capitalism has really taken over and people are so invested in money and appearances, and money has been a way for people to focus on appearances and look better. And there's so much beautiful things about the Arab community, about the generosity, the welcomingness, the quickness to help. And I wanted that to also appear in the poem and kind of sit against each other and maybe think about what's going on in that space in between those two things. And I think it feels important for me to address those things, particularly anti-Blackness. I don't feel like it's always addressed. And it's very present. And so in that poem, I was kind of trying to work with that. And I really love Hadisa as the symbol also of this, the statue of Mary in Lebanon that's kind of looming over the country. And there's all these stories in particularly in Christian communities, but also in all religious communities, because Hadisa is pretty important for a lot of people, that she like performs miracles and that different people have gone to Hadisa and a child has who was in a wheelchair is now able to walk. And there was, I remember when I was a kid, she was supposedly crying. And I really love the fantasy of this. At least for me, it feels like fantasy. I'm not religious, but I grew up in a lot of religiosity. So it makes up part of my life, the images that I see, you know, the things that I think about. And I really love the kind of that phantasm of this figure of Hadisa. And so I kind of wanted to twist it and have her as a symbol of looking down and being like, I don't actually like what's going on. And so that felt fun to play with as well.
Yeah, that's lovely. I love the way you don't allow us to separate the critique from the appreciation, and that it's all wound together, that it's all part of being Lebanese, is all of these complicated things together. And then the critique is very important, especially, as you say, the critique of anti-Blackness, but also to embrace all these other aspects and how they play in together. And I love the way you brought in the capitalism angle, because often we forget about class and money and especially capitalism, how it plays in into those other structures, right, of race and gender and the way we interact with each other and all of that. So I really appreciate that. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's great. On a more playful note, I love the opening poem. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit. It stands before section one. Mm-hmm. So to me, when I was reading it, it felt almost like a preface to the rest of the book. It's titled Nancy Ajram Made Me Gay. And so would you like to either maybe read a little bit from it before you talk about it, and then tell us the resonance of that reference and the title and both the playfulness of it and the way it sets up the rest.
Yeah, sure. All right. So Nancy Ajram Made Me Gay. Could be a woman, could be a man, could be someone floating in between or somewhere else, someone in a different country, on a different plane, a different part of Earth's tectonic plates. A space right between two of them, two men sharing a bed, but no one knows, a shattering. Earthquakes so normal, we all know the drill. Know to keep the good plates strapped in. Know that sometimes you wake up to shaking, you wake up to floating. those minutes in between sleep and the shake endless until they're not. You're up and out of the apartment, your pants still hang between your legs. Pull them up, running down the stairs, hoping no one sees, but someone always does.
Mm. Beautiful.
Thank you. So that poem, funnily enough, I've read it a lot, quite a lot in Montreal and kind of surrounding places, but mostly Montreal. And it's become a fan favorite, which is really fun. I also usually, before I read it, I sing a bit. And I sing part of Nancy Ajram's song, Yes, Alam, which is actually the part that she doesn't sing. It's like men singing in the background and it kind of builds and then she goes in.
I see.
And so I usually use that part beforehand. And I think it's like a kind of a grounding experience for me. Singing kind of helps me relax into the reading. A lot of people really love that poem and have sometimes people, friends of mine or like other people who've seen me read will request that I read that. So it's kind of thinking about the role of that poem and also, yeah, I wanted to have it as the preface to kind of tell you what this book was about. You know, it starts off and it's, you're there and it has all these kind of elements that I'm talking about in the book kind of woven in. And it is, I think about it a bit as this like song and dance that's happening, the poem itself. And it kind of ends on that Ahasmaka, which is another one of her songs that found fun to weave in. And so I wanted people to kind of be in that space when they started and to also have the queerness and the Arabness live together right there, right up front. And so when you open the book, you're like, okay, this is where we're going.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Beautiful. Love it. Yeah. Thank you for that. I want to talk about conversation number one. I love the way you play on the word body in that poem. And to me as a reader, it connects the human body and the landmass as a body, you know, geography, all of these things that you weave in together in that poem. So if you can talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. I've always been interested in, I mean, my first book's called Not Body. It's very centered in the body. But I was doing some Irish literature classes, actually, when I was in university, because Concordia, where I went, has a really good Irish studies program, actually. A lot of the teachers are really cool women and who are doing really interesting things in the Irish studies program. At the time at Concordia, and I'm not sure, it might still be the case, there's not a lot of women teachers. And so it was nice to have women teachers at the time. And so I did all these Irish studies classes. There were like performance classes, sexuality classes. And we talked a lot about Ireland in its being colonized by the British, being seen as a body. I was like Lady Ireland. She was a woman being colonized by the British man and kind of using how they were using that approach to think about what was happening there and kind of to kind of bring it to an embodied space, I guess. There was like poets like Seamus Heaney, who I was reading, who were kind of doing that. You can kind of relate that to any kind of country that has been colonized and thinking about colonization in an embodied way. But then for me, I wanted to push against that as well, because the country as woman trope is also a country as fertile, country as giving birth, growing things, that being taken away from the country by another country, and that symbolizing this loss. And while I understand why that mechanism is employed, I also kind of rubs me the wrong way, this idea of the country as the woman who's being, things are being taken from her. It's quite violent. And then it's also woman as birthing, which I don't love as like, you know, in terms of thinking about trans women and their inability to birth literal children, but also, you know, other women who aren't able to birth and who don't want to, all these things. I was like rubbing against it. And so all of this is kind of going through my mind as I'm thinking through the land as embodied as a woman. And so this poem was kind of trying to push against that, but also still thinking about the aliveness of land and the aliveness of a country, and trying to push it outside of a gendered scope, but also thinking about how we should take care of the land and we should take care of our countries, thinking about them as living things. And we don't have to, you know, what's the word? When you turn a thing into a human or like...
Anthropomorphizing.
Yes, thank you. We don't need to do that in order to appreciate the livingness of the land itself.
Yes, precisely. That was one of the things that struck me, is that you are not anthropomorphizing, and yet it was also this sort of layering, right? The thinking of it, and especially the idea of care, the caring for the land, the caring for the body, that came through very strongly in that poem. And it was very lovely, especially now with sort of climate disasters and the way we need to think about the land and the way we inhabit it, the way we embody it, the way all of these things together. Yeah.
Yeah. And it for me, it's come from a lot of also Indigenous knowledge, you know, like reading Indigenous writers and theorists and speakers who talk about the care that we should have for the land and the land as something equal to humans, but also not necessarily having to make it into a person, but thinking about how we take care of our lands. And this is like old stuff that for a lot of Indigenous folks within North America, that talking about the land as part of the connection, the whole world connection, you know, humans, animals, the land.
Absolutely.
The rivers and these things. And that's come from a lot of like Indigenous knowledge that I've learned from.
Right. I felt that that came through like in the resonances that you are using in that poem. I was intrigued listening to you talking about learning about Irish poetry and Irish history and how that comes into play as well. And it reminds us of the various intersections, widening our thinking. You know, we think of the specific, but also how there are these threads that tie it into all of these others.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for that. That's great. So much I want to talk to you about this little book, a seemingly little book, right? That's the thing about poetry. It's, it's so full of things. There's a lot in this about garbage. And of course, it's the garbage crisis in Lebanon that's, you know, the immediate reference or the immediate image that comes to mind. This image of garbage really goes through so many different layers. And I was struck by the subtitle to section 3, In the Heart of the Heart of More Garbage. And to me, that immediately evoked Etel Adnan, In the Heart of the Heart of Another Country, which also evokes, of course, William Gass, In the Heart of the Heart of Country. I should be careful here. Those were really so many layers, and I've only just like touched on two or three. So if you could please elaborate on that, because I think there's so much there.
Yeah. I mean, I was using Etel Adnan's book while writing my book. Often when I'm writing books, I have accompanying books that basically sit around me. And if I need inspiration or if I need kind of just to be jogged out of where my brain is and nothing is coming, I'll read some poetry. And there's certain books that are accompanying me throughout and that I can kind of rely on to bring me to a different space. And so that book was definitely one that was doing that, specifically thinking through the way that she, for her, it's Lebanon and California, and she's kind of going back and forth between them. All of her titles are like home, place, country, politics. She has more fun ones that I'm forgetting. Let's see, my house, my cat, my company, you know, that same person. But then, you know, that those things accompanying like more vital data about the US government. And she comes off initially as a serious writer, but she's also very playful. And I love that about her. So I was kind of using her as a helpful tool to experiment in my work and to kind of also, you know, we're thinking through similar things. And she's definitely a huge figure for me as a first queer Lebanese elder, you know, writer. She had been around for so long and had wrote so much. So she's kind of always in the background for me. And as I was thinking about that section and the poem that is also titled In the Heart of the Heart of More Garbage, that poem does the swinging back And fourth, it kind of goes, it's in France a little bit, it's in Montreal, it's in Beirut, it's in Zella. And so I kind of wanted that feeling that her book evokes and that, you know, the feeling that her book evoked in me while writing that. But then I thought it would be fun to add garbage to kind of bring us back also to the muck and the grossness and the everyday. Because I think garbage for me has like also symbolized the everyday and the things that we sometimes forget or ignore, particularly in places where garbage removal is systematic. We don't have to think about it anymore. And what happens, and that was the case in Lebanon, but then what happens when that stops, right? Everything we've consumed, everything we've not consumed is just around us and sitting there in the summer causing awful smell. What happens when those things we can no longer ignore? And so that felt like a very strong image to have throughout the book, because that's kind of the things that I'm addressing are sometimes things that we like to ignore. But I'm like, what happens when you can't ignore them? What happens when the things that are gross, the things that are come out of us, that are just there, what do we do with that? And so that's kind of what I was trying to evoke with the garbage.
Yeah, that's lovely. And again, it kind of ties in with how we started this conversation. It's all there, mm-hmm. right? You won't let us forget about the garbage and the mm-hmm. stink, but we're also talking and thinking, like reading and thinking about all these other things that also are important, some playful, some serious. And so much of the movement of which you evoke here, and you mentioned in Etel Adnan's poetry as well, there's mm-hmm. that movement from place to place and evocations of different places. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely resonating in your work as well. Not only do you do different places, reference different places, but I love the way you play with language and even typography. For example, at one point you talk about Ammo, which Ammo is, of course, the paternal uncle, but you spell it with a 3A, mm-hmm. right? Which is the sort of, if we were texting, mm-hmm. that's a Lebanese way of sort of signaling the A, mm-hmm. the letter A, which doesn't exist in English. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily always conventional in printed books where mm-hmm. they will do different kind of diacritical signaling of mm-hmm. the letter A. Mm-hmm. And you put that in there. And then at one point you have a poem that starts with, written in Arabic, Ibn, mm-hmm. right? You have to read it in Arabic and it means son, mm-hmm. son of, right? Mm-hmm. So I love the way you're doing that. And maybe you can talk a little bit about those choices.
Sure. Yeah, it was really nice because my publishers, they were very great about just kind of letting me do the things that I wanted to do. And for me, you know, kind of having, in thinking about the multiplicity of things, I kind of wanted to have it all. I wanted to have a bunch of different ways. And I think for that, the poem where Amo appears with the three is The Space Between You and Us, maybe?
Yeah, or the short story.
Yes. And this one felt this poem is very community minded. It's kind of thinking about Arab community and like Arab community across kind of, and also racialized communities, because Park X, where I live in Montreal, is a neighborhood that's quite Greek and quite South Asian. So a lot of Indian, Bangladeshi, Pakistani communities live there. And now more Arabs, particularly Syrians and Lebanese, are also coming to this neighborhood. And it's a very tiny neighborhood. It's actually one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in all of North America.
Seriously? Yeah. That's so interesting.
It's like a square, basically. And it's just like houses that are filled with multiple generations of families. So it's extremely dense, but it's also like such a beautiful neighborhood and I love it. And I really love being in community there. So that poem was kind of thinking through that. And so having Ammo with the three felt important in that poem, kind of as, you know, the ways that some people who can't write in Arabic will have to write that way, you know, like,
right.
like diaspora kids who have learned to speak Arabic with their families at home, but don't know how to write in actual Arabic script. That's how they will write, you know? And so I kind of wanted to have that as someone who, like, I write and read in Arabic, I speak Arabic, but my sister can speak Arabic, but she can't read or write. So even between us, we have such different experiences. And I kind of wanted to have that multiplicity of experience. And I want to include more actual Arabic script in my work. And I really love a lot of that happening. And so Ibn was kind of my little bit of, and like with that poem, it plays a lot with the idea of the sun as the person.
Yeah.
And the sun as the actual sun. Yes. So I kind of already had that, but I wanted something for Arabic speakers and people who could read in Arabic to have their own extra bit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it seems like there are all these little nuggets in here for different readers. Mm-hmm. You know, that pleasure of surprise, of encounter, mm-hmm. of something that you recognize that you don't expect. Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of that sprinkled through. And maybe that's also part of one of my questions is the way you have this structured in conversations, conversation mm-hmm. number one, conversation number two. Mm-hmm. And the interlocutors seem to shift a little bit in mm-hmm. these conversations. So maybe you can talk about who you envision is having these conversations right. and how those conversations function in the mm-hmm. in the book as a whole.
Yeah. So when I had written the book, initially the conversations didn't exist. Something felt missing. I was like kind of not feeling satisfied with where I was at. This kind of towards the end of the process of writing the book and having to send it to my publisher. And I was like, something's missing. Something is not, I want something else. And I want something to hold things together. And I want more playfulness. At the time, my partner was writing a book as well, a book of short stories called Personal Attention Role Play. And they were trying to write a story that was just dialogue. And the story is called The Cue, and it's based on The Cue by Vladimir Sarkov. I think Sarkov. They had read the translation of the Russian novel that's novel just in conversations. There's nothing to guide you about who's talking. And that initial cue was people standing in line in Russia trying to get provisions. The cue that they wrote was people standing in line during the pandemic waiting for things. I've always been interested in conversation and the way that dialogue works. And so I kind of took it as a challenge. I was like, oh, I want to do that too. So I kind of copied them. And I was like, what would that do for the book? And I thought it's really interesting with conversation in these instances and in the instances in Felix's book, Felix Chalbradley, and Vladimir Sarkov's book, you're getting these instances of conversations kind of flitting in and out and encountering each other, different dialogues between different people. And you get this whole experience of different people in a single space. Whereas mine, it's different people. They're not in the same space, but they're in the same kind of community, the same social milieu, the same people who have a certain similar understanding, at least about certain things. And you're kind of getting different voices and different people and different people kind of interacting with each other, pushing against each other in terms of certain ideas or being surprised by each other, questioning each other. And I think the main reason I wanted the conversations was because I wanted to have questions in the book. I wanted to have these questions that people were asking. And I didn't want myself to feel like I was the authority in the book giving answers. I actually wanted just to have all these questions that we're constantly asking each other, we're constantly asking ourselves to be present in the book and have them open space for more questions and more dialogue between people rather than have the book be something that was like, this is how things should be. And they're not like that. And I think it's wrong because I think there's nuance in everything. And while I'm always pro leftist kind of community oriented agenda, I do know that, you know, there's people of all experiences who beyond, you know, like extremely conservative right wing people who I really don't care about and don't want to have conversations with, and other people who have the time and energy to do that can do that. But, you know, people who are people like people in my family who I have had conversations with who've changed their minds about things, who had an idea of something based on, I don't even know, like a feeling or something that they heard once and then kept it. And then they decide, this is my opinion about this thing. But that could be pushed. People that could be kind of their opinion about something could be massaged out, and we could have talked about it and kind of try to figure out why anyone thinks anything. And I wanted those conversations to kind of do that work, to do the massaging, to create more questions, to kind of constantly build towards more care and more open dialogue, basically. Yeah, I wanted humor in those parts too. I wanted them to be fun. I wanted them to be funny and not like kind of a slog.
Right, right. And then this, I don't know, at one point, you know, in one of the poems and things like that is sort of, we don't always know.
Yeah.
You know, we don't always, like, but the question is still important. Mm-hmm. I love the way you're describing how you came to that, because it gives such a hopeful feel to these conversations, which we sometimes feel we are in hopeless situations, like the garbage situation in Lebanon, which is just like overflowing and it seems insurmountable. But you're juxtaposing that with these open-ended conversations that can help us think through things together and be open to one another, which is really nice. Thank you. So there is a short story in this book of poetry. And it's set in 2040.
Yes.
So it's a futuristic story. As I was reading it, I have to tell you, I was like thinking, oh, this is like the talking about the Civil War. So it's like 1980s. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, no, it's in the future. Like, no, it's now. I had to keep reminding myself at different parts. And I thought that was really clever. Mm. So maybe you can talk about this prose story in the middle of poetry and then the setting and all of that.
Mm-hmm. So yesterday at this talk, Safia Al-Hala was saying that for her, she's a poem person. She likes to focus on poems and likes to work on the poems and wants them to be kind of the biggest structure. And then she has to put them in the books. But for her, the poem is the space of like, that's where I want to be. For me, I'm more of a book person. Both of my collections, and I think anything that I write, I'm constructing a whole. And all the pieces inside are involved in working together to create a whole and to kind of bring about everything that I want to talk about. And I like to think of them obviously working alone, of course, but also working in service of each other. As I was talking about the conversations, those came in to be in service of other things. When there was less humor, they came in to bring the humor in or to bring in the humor with the hard questions, you know. And the short story initially didn't exist when I had pitched the book. I had written the whole book and then had, after submitting in, they were like, great, this is the book that we're publishing. I was like, actually, I'm taking half of this out and I'm re-editing and I'm going in. And I worked with Trish Sella. She's also mixed race, a Canadian Lebanese trans poet. And her work is amazing. She's very undervalued, I think. And she was a beautiful editor. And so she kind of, we work together through the process as well. I'm also just a bit of a perfectionist. So I was going in and being like, all right, how is this serving the whole? How is everything coming together? I was having a really hard time with the poems at one point. I needed some space from poetry because I just felt like I couldn't look at the poems and think that they were good. I was in that editing process where I was like, I can't look at them. I can't look at them. I keep avoiding going in and looking at them. And I have a deadline. And so I have to look at them at some point. And I thought, what if I write some prose? You know, what if I try to go that way and make some space for myself and try something else so that I can come back to poetry after refreshed? And so I did that. That's why I wrote that short story. But then I realized as I was writing the short story that it could serve a lot as well. And I love the idea of kind of hybrid books. And so I was like, actually, I'm going to put this short story in. And yeah, the story, like the thing that kind of one of the driving forces was this idea of the cyclical nature of war and of colonialism and the after effects of those things on a people, on a country. And so I wanted it to feel, putting it in 2040, I wanted it to feel like it was constantly coming back. And something I think a lot of Lebanese literature is that a lot of people do talk about the Civil War because it's such a big, impactful thing that happened. And whether you live through it or your parents live through it or your grandparents live through it, because I think at this point, there's a generation who has grandparents who are the ones that lived through it, not parents. You kind of are getting the ripple effects of it. And it is a big thing that also caused mass immigration and fleeing of the Lebanese people to other countries. And so it has had a huge effect on our community. In the book, the character would be someone whose grandmother was the one who lived through the war and the kids were young, quite young. Yeah, I wanted that person to be someone who was contending with those ripple effects. And for me, what I see happening in Lebanon now, it is kind of, you know, a ripple effect of not just the war, but colonialism, the French occupation, the ways that certain laws were put in place by the French that are now kind of being assimilated into Lebanese culture, and like this certain kind of amnesia about things. I think when I talk to my family, you know, I'll be like, oh, I was reading, you know, I'm doing some research about the fact that Lebanon and Syria and Palestine and parts of, like, the kind of parts of Jordan were just the same place. You know, there was borders didn't exist in the same way. Nations didn't exist in the same way. And everyone's cousins, basically, you know, and they're like, what are you talking about? No. And I'm just like, that's not that long ago. You know, like 1920 is when that separation would have happened. 1920 is 100 years ago, but it's really not that long ago. And it's affected our people and it continues to affect our people, but people forget about it. And this history is not taught. And so then a lot of awful kind of stuff happens between Lebanese people and Syrian people and Palestinian people and within the war that has happened, that for me, I can see how it happened. And I've done a lot of research into what happened and how people were pitted against each other. But there's this amnesia that forced people into weird positions and weird, you know, religious kind of structures and boxes, when people used to change religions all the time based on taxes at the time and the Ottoman Empire taxing people who were of a certain religion. And they were like, well, now we're Christian. And they're like, nope, now we're Muslim, you know, and like how these religions actually come from a very similar place, you know, Judaism as well. And so there's just a lot of, you know, lack of understanding of our histories that I'm kind of interested in, and the ways that those things, they ripple and come back, but then we don't know where they come from. Similarly, there's French laws that were put into place against homophobia, or not against homophobia, I wish, yeah, but against, unfortunately, homosexuality.
Yes.
But people think that that's an Arab thing. Everyone thinks, oh, it's the Arab people that are homophobic. At this point, yes, there are Arab people who are homophobic because they have played into this narrative and they have, you know, been told that this is how it goes. But that also is a law that came in the 1920s and wasn't even present before. People weren't treating queer people in the same way. So all these things that happened in the past are important to our future and are important to what's happening and continue to have effects on the future. I pushed it a little bit past where we're at now because I was also thinking about I kind of wrote it when the port explosion happened, mm-hmm. and I couldn't get past this image of all of the windows shattering and just complete destruction, and the ways that, given the economic situation in Lebanon, I wrote it actually before the lira depreciated in value, but I had a feeling that things were not going to be great. So I was like, how are people actually going to be able to cope and build again after this? And so I was kind of thinking about that and what it would be like in the future and possibly things coming back and happening again, and things that people thought were behind them because they're pushing them away and ignoring them and being like, that was then, how that will just come back. The thing with trauma is if you don't deal with it, it's going to come back and hit you threefold, you know? So I was kind of thinking about this like national trauma and the ways that it permeates in people's lives. And then I also just wanted to have a character who was queer and trans and used they pronouns, who wasn't mistreated by their family. Their family just took it in their stride and they were like, well, this is how it is. And that felt really important to me. So it felt fun to have that character in the book as well.
Yeah, very nice. You know, there's a lot of discussion now about the amnesia of the Civil War, mm-hmm. and how people don't talk about it. But you're taking us farther back and saying, mm-hmm. there's another history that is also not being talked yeah. about, that is still having its ramifications on people's lives. I appreciated that very much. Yeah. It's also about a family. It's about people caring. The aspect of care is still there, mm-hmm. you know, in yeah. spite of all these, like, sort of a dystopian vision. Yet mm-hmm. within that, there is this very touching human connection and care that goes on, and, mm-hmm. and that's carries us through all of this.
Yeah, I wanted to have that, those moments be kind of the grounding moments, you know, the different ways that people think about each other and care about each other, and those small, like, intimate moments to be present, because I think those are the things that keep us going and pull us through. And and then there's obviously a fantastical element.
Yes,
that felt fun.
Yes, that was great. Yeah,
yeah,
wonderful.
That it felt playful and
yeah,
a fun addition, and kind of a, I think when you're writing fiction, you have to have like the driving force of the narrative, or like the thing that kind of shifts the normal into not normal. And when the normal is war and all this awfulness happening, what is the thing that will shift it into not normal? And I was like, well, I guess we're going into a fantastical world, because that will shift it into something different, and that will be able to start the story.
Yeah. Terrific. There's so much more that we could talk about, but I was told not to go on for too long. And I feel like we could go on for another hour.
Yeah, I'm a very chatty person.
No, so I love it. It's you know, and talking to a writer about their work, you gain so much depth of insight as to how this work came together and the work it's doing. And so I really appreciate that. Thank you very much for this wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I hope
thank
you have
you.
Too.
Yeah, I also did. Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Wonderful. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Today's episode was hosted by Pauline Homsi-Vinson. It was produced by Muhammad Jafar and Esma Baban, and edited by Muhammad Jafar. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish, and our logo was created by Maisara Abdulhaq. Scene Jim is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Scene Jim is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Check out our website, scenejimpodcast.org, for more information on our guests and to view videos of their readings. Thank you for listening.